Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, and I'm your host. The mission in my work is to empower people to manifest their values of compassion and wellness in their everyday lives. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, and On Being Vegan. I'm also the creator and host of the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, which gives you everything you need to make the transition healthfully, joyfully, and deliciously. You can check out 30dayveganchallenge.com, and you can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, compassionatecook.com, and from there you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and Pinterest, and you can definitely join my mailing list. This podcast is listener supported, so please head over to the website compassionatecook.com to show your support. I need your support more than ever. I've increased the frequency and the content and contact with all of you, which means it's taking a lot more resources to do the show, and I can't do it without you. And sponsorships are low, and I need your help. So please consider a year-end gift that you can make in your name or in the name of a loved one or in the name of a favorite organization that I'll name on the podcast. So please, please show your support. I want to thank those who are supporting me first and foremost, the wonderful Platinum members, U.S. Army Captain Janie Mena, Deborah McDowell, members of the Norwegian Vegan Society, Grace Rodriguez, Tim Anderson, David Cabrera and Alexander Gray in New York City, Alexander Gray Associates in New York City at alexandergray.com, Peter and Eric of Peace Food Cafe in New York City, that's peacefoodcafe.com, Chris Hanna of Propagandi at propagandi.com, Anonymous in Melbourne, Australia, and Kavitha. And I am grateful for all of your support. Thank you so much. And thank you for everyone who supports the podcast. As you can see, I have no gold members to thank, and I need your support. If you value this podcast, please become a member. You can go and check out the different gifts, the different levels, and know that because of you, we are literally creating a compassionate world for both human and non-human animals. So I love autumn, which has very quickly turned to winter. Literally last night, I'm in Northern California, and last night we had freezing temperatures for the first time, I think, in a long time. It's pretty rare that we drop down to freezing, and it's going to be like that for the next few days, which is awesome because I just put up my Christmas tree. And so just being snuggled up in my living room with the Christmas tree lights on is pretty cool, and I love it. And this is the time of year that my husband and I usually go away. We usually do kind of a large trip, usually somewhere in, I don't know, somewhere in Europe. It really depends. In the last few years, we visited the UK, which I love. And I think some people think it's counterintuitive because they think late fall or winter in the UK is horrific. But I don't. I actually love it. We usually go in like late October. Early November. We're usually away for David's birthday, which is unfair because he just has the coolest birthdays. His birthdays are always somewhere wonderful, and my birthday's in March, and we don't usually go away in March. There's nothing in March, so my birthdays aren't as cool as David's birthdays. But we didn't go away this year because we have chosen to renovate some parts of our house. We bought a new house about a year and a half ago, and it's amazing. It is literally a dream come true in the sense that I am living among the trees, but I didn't have to leave Oakland, which is my favorite city, and we love where we live. But I really so desperately wanted to live among the trees, but I didn't want to go to the mountains. I didn't want to leave the city. So this house was put in front of us. Literally, it was quite a gift. And so we are very high up from the street. We're not in a hill house. We're not on stilts or anything like that, which a lot of houses in the hills, in the Berkeley and Oakland Hills, are. But we just happen to be in a unique house on this really pretty street that's 100 feet up, or it's 120 feet up or so from the street. So we're built into the hillside. And it means that because nobody else is as high as we are, from every side of our house, we just see oak trees and wildlife. And it's amazing. And then, you know, a mile from where we live, we can, even less than that, we can walk down to shopping districts, and David walks to the casual carpool, and I get to enjoy deer every day and all of it, just skunks and raccoons and squirrels and so many different kinds of birds. And we're close enough for David to commute. I mentioned the casual carpool. I don't know if a lot of you have heard of this. It seems to be pretty unique to the Bay Area. Basically, the casual carpool is a way to enable people to get into the carpool lane going across the bridge to San Francisco. It used to be free. So it used to be that you'd get enough people in a car to go across for free, but now they charge like $2.50 or something like that. The idea is that you stand in line as you do at a bus stop and you get in strangers' cars and go across the bridge. And it's been going on for 40 years or so. I think it started in Berkeley, which is pretty typical because it's just this wonderful grassroots community thing, and there's never been a problem. There have never been any reports of problems. It's just a community grassroots thing. And so that's how David goes into San Francisco, and he takes the bus home, but it's pretty cool. So there's a casual carpool line just about a half a mile from our house. So anyway, so it's wonderful and it's fantastic. And it also has meant that this house needed a lot of work. And so we have taken it on. And this last round of renovations included the kitchen. And I can't even tell you how amazing it is because I've never had a proper kitchen. Anytime you've ever seen a video of me doing a cooking demonstration, it's never been in my kitchen. I have borrowed friends and neighbors' kitchens because my kitchens, wherever I've lived, have never been never been conducive to shooting a video and never been conducive to really enjoying being in the space and cooking. So I'm getting literally verklempt right now because the kitchen is almost done and it's a proper kitchen and I can function in it and move in it and it's remarkable. So we just did not go away because we have done all this work, and I'm really looking forward to being able to shoot videos in there and to cook. And I have kind of announced, I guess, formally on Facebook, and I guess I'll announce it here, but I am working on another cookbook. And I don't want to announce what it's about yet, but it is incorporating lots of content that I think you're going to love. I know you're going to love that I think is really needed out there. And I think couching that content in a cookbook is the best way to get it to a larger audience. So I am super excited about it. And now I'll get to do it in a kitchen. And Michiko has just joined me. You may hear her. There she is. And so it meant that we didn't go away for a big trip, but we do love taking little trips. And as I said, I love Oakland, and I also, both of us, love California. We moved here from the East Coast, from New Jersey, and it was something we both wanted to do. I had fallen in love with California many, many years ago and had known that I was going to move here. And so when I fell in love with David and we clearly had, we were together, I asked if he wanted to come with me because I wanted to move here after I finished grad school. And so we both moved here and it's been home ever since. And so one of the things we have been doing specifically very intentionally is we have this new goal to sleep in every county in California. And I think there are about 52 counties. There aren't about. I think there are either 52 or 53 counties. And we've slept in 19. We've been in more than 19, but we have slept in 19. And so that's what we've been doing. We've been taking these small weekend trips. And one of the things I love to do is find kind of just the best bed and breakfast, the best place to stay. I love finding unique places. And as I've talked about before, you know, I really love going to bed and breakfast and enjoying a breakfast that the proprietor makes vegan. And I usually ask the bed and breakfast first, so that I can feel them out. And, you know, if someone's just completely disagreeable, I'm not going to go to their bed and breakfast. But for the most part, I find that people are incredibly accommodating. So we were going to Grass Valley to spend the night. I was speaking at Animal Place in Grass Valley, and we were going to spend the night. And so I was looking at bed and breakfast in both Grass Valley and Nevada City, and there wasn't a huge selection. So I had narrowed it down to one that just looked absolutely adorable. It's called the Emma Nevada House, and it's so pretty, just this gorgeous, gorgeous Victorian, probably late Victorian house, and it was just really pretty and had great reviews. And so I just booked it because it was kind of the last place I had found, and I just didn't feel like looking anymore. And I booked it. And then when I talked to the woman, I think she called me for some reason, and she said, "Great, we're really looking forward to having you come. And so do your husband and you have any dietary preferences?" And I said, "Oh yeah, we're vegan." And she said, "Oh dear. Oh boy. You know, I am really happy to refund you the money for the breakfast because I am just afraid I'm not going to be able to provide a breakfast for you." And she was so sweet because she was so nervous about it. And she said, "We had a vegetarian couple here recently. And let's see, what did I make them? I made them some oatmeal and I made them some fake and bacon I got from the store and gluten-free bread. And that was it. And I just felt like I just wasn't able to give it to them, you know." And she said, "Vegetarian, that was one thing, but vegan is just so much harder. And I'm just nervous." And so she said all this, and I said, "You know," I said, "I appreciate that so much. I said, first of all, thank you for your honesty. Second of all, thank you for offering that option to have a refund for the breakfast." I said, "But I just want to push back a little bit and say, you know, it's not as unfamiliar as you think." And I said, "We tend to have this notion, as you've heard me say, that we have, you know, regular food and normal food over here in this one box, and we have vegan food in this other box. And the vegan food is so unfamiliar." And I said, "Really, if you think about it, you know, vegan food is food that we already eat." And I did my whole spiel. It's fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and beans and mushrooms and grains and herbs and spices. And I said, "You know, it's just food." I said, "We don't call an apple a vegan apple. We just say an apple because it's just food." And I said, "I bet that a lot more of what you make, that food you make and eat and make for your guests, is more vegan than you think." And she said, "Wow, you know, I never thought about it that way. When you put it that way, you're right." And so we just started having this conversation back and forth about what that meant and what that looked like and, you know, what she would make for us. And it was a lovely conversation. And she started feeling a lot better about it. And I told her I was going to send her some recipes, and I have. And she was so open and honest, and we just had this dialogue. And by the end of the conversation, she said, "You know, I really should be vegan. I know that I would be healthier for it, and I really admire what you do and appreciate what you do, and I could really learn from you." So it was this lovely conversation, and I asked her, it was interesting, because what I wanted to do was say, "Well, what is it that you make for your guests so that I could offer, you know, vegan versions?" And I have to say that what she makes for her guests was so incredibly animal product heavy that it wasn't easy to just say, "Okay, well, you could do this, this, and this," because it was some crazy casserole with eggs and cheese and meat all mixed in together. And I knew she wasn't going to be someone who was going to make a tofu scramble. And she said, you know, she and her husband they took over this bed and breakfast for a year. They're not chefs. And, you know, they make one thing for their guests that, you know, everybody loves because it's so rich and fatty, of course. But she just was afraid, you know, to make separate, you know, because she makes one thing for everybody and then she would have to make a separate thing for us. And I gave her the pancakes and I gave her the scones and all of that. And she was so open to that. But in the end, we decided to take the discount because friends were in town for this event. And we decided to have breakfast with them and just go to Ike's in Nevada City, which has a huge vegan menu. And we were happy with that. By the time I saw her, she was so sweet. She actually bought us so delicious egg, the soy nog. I said eggnog, but the soy nog. And it was so sweet because she said, "I bought this food. I thought you would like it." And of course, it was very thoughtful. And that morning, you know, we were out and about and we came back to pack up and leave. And she said, "Thank you so much." She said, "You're so sweet." And I gave her a couple of my cookbooks, and she said it worked out because I had I had a vegetarian, I had a gluten-free, I had a this and that. And I said, "I am going to help you so that you don't feel you have to make four different breakfasts for everybody. I'm going to give you what you need, hook you up so that you feel that you could make one breakfast for everybody regardless of their dietary preferences, and they're all going to love it." And she goes, "Yeah, I want to do that. That's so exciting and how great." So, so it was a really good experience, and I really, really do believe that when you speak to the highest in people, they respond with the highest in them. That is my motto for the day. That is my tweetable for the day, is when you speak to the highest in people, they respond with the highest that's in them. And I'm going to put that on the page for this podcast episode and tweet it out there and remember it, because that's the kind of interactions we can have all the time with people. Did she become a vegan bed and breakfast over? No, but I mean, seeds were planted. I'm going to keep following up with her. And, You know, and in the end, if she makes fewer animal-based breakfasts, it's going to be a good thing. And she'll be able to accommodate you when you call them and say you'd like to stay at their bed and breakfast. So that is that. That is my week. And I'm loving life right now. So speaking of loving life and wonderful people who inspire me, I want to share a letter that demonstrates, as I often do, why I have hope in the work I do and why this podcast is valuable and important. And I'm just going to say it again, why I need your support, because you've heard me read these love letters again and again and again. And this podcast has reached people all around the world, which is phenomenal and so incredibly humbling and so incredibly validating that I need to keep doing it. And in order to keep doing it, I need your help. So here is a letter from Belen Molina Prieto, and she joined the Compassionate Cooks Club a few months back, but I wanted to read her letter because it's lovely. Dear Colleen, she said, if I wanted to keep this email short and simple, I would say this: you inspire me. Thank you. The days are brighter since I found your podcast. No, that wouldn't be an overstatement. But what you've done to my life is far from short and simple. You have turned my life upside down, and the feeling of peace and joy that comes with being vegan and with becoming awake is magical and hard to explain. It's kind of like when you hold your baby for the first time. It's that special. You might not know this, but for the past few months, you've been the best friend I've ever had. My husband made fun of me when I started to refer to you as my friend Colleen. Now, whenever I say my friend said this or my friend said that, he knows I'm talking about you, my friend, the friend that changed our lives. We are forever grateful. Colleen, you've provided me with the support I needed, as well as with valuable resources that empower me and many others to live a compassionate and passionate life. I now feel well-equipped to spread the word. Besides being a mom, I've never felt so passionate about anything else in my life before. It's exciting because there's so much I want to do to help, and scary because becoming awake hurts every day. However, your words and those of your readers keep me optimistic. Yes, I love listening to you read emails from your listeners. Please never stop doing so. Well, I'm so glad I could share yours, Belen. I want everyone I know to listen to your podcast. I want them to feel what I feel, what your listeners feel. Every day I wake up and cannot wait to ride along with you as I drive my son to preschool or to his therapy sessions. Your words, wisdom, compassion, and anecdotes have enriched my life, my mind, and my heart. I'm joyful and at peace every single day, even when I suffer with the animals and cry, because I know now that those tears come from love, and that slowly but surely that love will spread and make other people change as well. Now everywhere I go, I'm aware of animal suffering, and most often than not, I'm not afraid to speak up. My journey begins a little over a year ago on April of 2012. To make a long story short, my toddler son had a lesion in his left frontal lobe and had to have surgery to remove it. Thankfully, the lesion was benign. Then a few months later, he was diagnosed with autism. The reason I tell you this is because the ordeal we went through and the challenges we face every single day have changed my perception of life completely. Not only did I become much more interested in health than I was before, we were already an almost all-organic, chemical-free household, but the big things in life became much more meaningful. Speaking my truth and living according to my values of compassion gives me the strength I need to face life with a smile. Raising a beautiful little person to be compassionate and kind to all living things fills me with joy. We first became vegetarian after watching Forks Over Knives and reading the China Study. I was mostly vegan, except when it wasn't convenient. She put that in quotes. My husband became an ovo-lacto vegetarian, unable to quit his daily habit of drinking a latte prepared with cow's milk or eating chicken's eggs during the weekend. I had to negotiate with him what we could do with our son's diet, since he thought going vegan was too extreme. In the end, I agreed that I would give my son, Camillo, scrambled eggs once a week, but the rest of his diet would remain vegan. Around the same time, a friend of mine told me about your podcast. It took me months before I decided to listen to it, but I'm so glad I did. I still have a few more episodes to listen to before I'm up to date, and to tell you the truth, I'm not looking forward to not having a podcast to listen to every day. I've been spoiled. I have enjoyed every single podcast episode, but the episode that had the greatest impact on me was the one called Motherhood and Maternal Instincts. Given what I've been through in the past year, this episode shook me to my core. Knowing the suffering that comes with the fear of losing a child, I wish no living being would ever have to endure that pain. I decided to play this episode for my husband after picking him up from work, and to my surprise, I watched him listen attentively and cry a lot. From that day on, we became vegan. No more negotiations or trying to convince anyone. We are now 100% vegan. People often ask us why we're vegan. Is it for health reasons or for the animals? Before, I used to say it was for health reasons. Now I proudly tell them that it's for the animals. I sometimes struggle trying to understand why people who know the truth about how animals are treated go back to eating animals or their secretions. Ironically, the friend that recommended your podcast to me is no longer vegan. When I found out about this, I was disappointed and quite sad. But then I thought, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have listened to your podcast in the first place. And if it wasn't for your podcast, who knows if my husband, my son, and I would be vegan today. I decided to sponsor your podcast because I've gotten so much out of it that becoming a member is the least I can do to help you on your mission. I wish I could help with more, but I'm a stay-at-home mom and we have a tight budget. I do, however, want to offer my assistance in anything you might need. And then she offers some volunteering. Thank you so much, Belen. Thank you for everything you do, my dear friend Colleen. Hugs from Chandler, Arizona. Belen, Hubert, my hubby, and Camillo, my son. I'm so grateful. Thank you, Belen, so much. And I'm sure your letter will move listeners the way it's moved me. It is so beautiful, and I appreciate it so much. And I appreciate your support so much. And I will leave it at that. And rely on all of you to do what you're able to do so that we can continue this work. Now I'm going to take a short break, and when I return, we're going to go right into our WWCPGD segment. For those who don't know, that's the What Would Colleen Patrick Goodrow Do segment, in which I'll be sharing your calls and emails and tweets and my responses to your questions. So we'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to the WWCPGD segment, which is basically our time together for me to answer your questions directly. And I encourage you to call, email, or tweet your questions to me. You can tweet anytime using the hashtag WWCPGD, or you can email me at WWCPGD@compassionatecooks.com. When you hashtag, obviously, you can also follow me at Patrick Goodrow, which is at Twitter. Also, as you know, I'm taking calls once a week. So visit CompassionateCook.com and go to Ask Colleen Your Question under the podcast menu. You can find the telephone number there and the information about calling. As I've said, I certainly don't have all the answers, but I do have a lot of opinions. So I am happy to share them with you if you ask. And today I'm going to be answering an email and three phone calls. We've had so many amazing calls in the last 3 weeks now, so they're piling up, and I want to get these out to you as quickly as I can. So we're going to start with our first caller, Janelle.
Well, you may have addressed this at some point. I haven't made it through all the podcasts yet, but I'm calling to ask if you have any advice for couples who may be one vegan and one not. I've been struggling lately with... I went vegan after getting married, and it's been 3 years for me now, but it's really kind of a stressor in the relationship, I guess.
How does it play itself out that it's stressful? Is it like every meal? Is it an issue? Like, tell me what's going on.
Not every meal. No, I cook, and he'll eat what I cook. So he's kind of vegan by default at home. I also do the shopping, and I won't buy meat, but I will buy cheese and dairy products if he puts them on the list. So it's mostly when we go out, or he'll occasionally go purchase something and cook it in the house. The smell bothers me now. And we go out probably at least once a week.
So it sounds like it is that. So when he comes home, so just to clarify, he comes home with meat that he'll cook in the house?
Right, occasionally, okay. Yeah.
So I did talk about this on a podcast episode recently. I can't remember what it's called, but it is about this very issue about relationships. And maybe it was called Vegan Dating, or maybe it was Drawing the Line, and it was about specifically this, is, you know, keeping a vegan home. And one of the things I talked about, because it sounds like what you're dealing with, there's a couple things going on. It's that it's in your home, and it's that it's out of your home when he's eating animals. So if I'm understanding correctly, it's painful when you're out with him eating out at a restaurant and he hasn't shifted and he hasn't moved and he hasn't done anything differently. And it's painful,
right?
And it's problematic. And when you're in your sanctuary, your space, your home, there's the smell that's offensive. You, even though you cook and shop, you're also, there's also cheese. You're buying cheese. You're allowing that in your house. So am I right in that? Right. It's kind of both of those things. So the one that there is a really practical answer for is the stuff in the house. In the episode that I did, I talked about you together coming up with a plan that works for both of you so that he feels that it's his home and he can, you know, have some freedom to do what he wants because this is his home, and that you feel that he's honoring what your feelings are about this issue. And I do think that some of it comes from you, you know, I'm sure he knows already, and just saying, I really care. Of course, I love you. And this means so much to me. And, you know, here's where it's painful for me. So one of the things that I recommended is that, you know, maybe if it's opening the refrigerator and seeing animal products that's really upsetting for you, what about maybe getting a second refrigerator where he can keep his, let's just say it's meat and or let's just say it's dairy and eggs. And maybe you both agree that that meat is not allowed in the house and cooking meat is not allowed in the house. Would he be willing to do that? But if you have a separate refrigerator where he keeps, say, the dairy, would he live with that? So finding a compromise so that you both feel heard and you both feel honored, I think, could go a long way in relieving some of the tensions that you probably feel, both of you, when you're dealing with this, which is pretty much every day because you share a home together, right?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And then the other stuff, which is related, has more to do with what's a little harder to do, which is letting go, which is you letting go. Because I know, it's hard. It is not easy. You love him. He's a good person. He's a kind person. He cares about you. He loves you. And he's doing this thing that you, you know, have stopped doing because it's antithetical to your values, I'm guessing.
We're both animal lovers and have some rescue cats and rescue dog. And so it's hard for me to understand why he hasn't taken the next thought step that I did and extend that to all animals, I guess. So.
Well, you probably, right, you said you've been vegan for 3 years, and I'm guessing you're not 3 years old, right? So you had a time in your life when you also loved animals and ate them. So you can understand it. I mean, it's in the sense that you lived it. And that's what I would encourage you to remember, is that you've been there, you understand there was some block, and then at some point that block was removed and you were able to stop. If he feels, even just in you thinking it, while he's sitting there and eating, it's going to create this tension back and forth that, you know, sometimes even loved ones will feel that they will do less in terms of making a change because you want them to. And in other words, the pressure, right. I mean, right. It's just kind of basic psychology. So the pressure that he feels and the guilt that he feels, you know, the only way he can kind of control it is by, like, doing, you know, assertively still consuming something that he wants to consume. Now, if you mentally started just doing some exercises mentally to let go in terms of, you know, I can't do anything about this. All I can do is, you know, find these compromises in a practical way. I love him. He's a good person. He's a kind person, but I have to let go. If you start doing that even mentally, the dynamic that happens between you, I promise you, will shift because you're changing the dance. And when one person changes the dance, the other person is forced to change the dance. And he might go, well, why isn't she saying anything anymore? What is she doing? And he'll maybe come to these conclusions on his own. So try some of those things. Try some of the practical things. Try some of your own letting go inside and see how that goes. And check out that podcast episode as well.
Okay, thank you. I will.
Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, it does. I hadn't thought about, of course, there was a time when I didn't think this way as well. Just feel so ingrained now, but of course, that wasn't that long ago.
Exactly.
So thank you.
I love it. You're welcome. Thanks, Janelle. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Janelle. That was so awesome. Next, we have Bonnie.
Hi, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. You sound like you're from Michigan. Is that presumptuous of me?
I'm actually from upstate New York, living in New Hampshire.
What? I was so off. Oh, my gosh. I'm embarrassed.
I know. It's a bizarre accent.
It's great. It's maybe the combination of New Hampshire, New York makes Michigan. That's what I hear.
It's possible.
Well, great. Well, what's your question?
Well, it's kind of an advocacy question. I find myself being really excited about being vegan and wanting to kind of, well, you know, educate people, I guess, more than anything. And in doing so, like posting things on Facebook and not wanting to be overly exuberant and overly, you know, crazy about it, but wanting people to get excited and wanting to let them know, but not wanting to push too much. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just trying to figure out what the line is. You know, when do you educate and when do you cross over and push people away? Sure. You know, and I can't really tell. Sometimes people just don't post for a while and you mm-hmm. think, okay, maybe they're not posting anymore. And then it's like, well, maybe they're banning me from Facebook. I don't know.
Right.
But, you know, when do you know that you've crossed that line and you're, you know, like I'm telling people, you know, why don't you watch Meat or Meat or Earthlings? You know, I really think you should watch this and make your own decisions. And I really don't think that I'm going over the line, but, you know, how do you know when you've gone over the line?
Such a great question. And I think so many people can identify with this. And I'll tell you what I think, I'll tell you what works for me. And it's really simple because you said it. And you'll hear the difference now when you start thinking about what you want to post in the future. So absolutely post, absolutely share what you care about. But there is absolutely a difference between wanting to inspire and wanting to educate, wanting to give information and wanting to change people, wanting to share a film and telling people to watch it. Do you see what I mean? Because when the language is, please watch this video, or this is really important, you need to know this, immediately people go, don't tell me what to do. I don't need to watch that. You don't have to tell me what I need to do. There's just this thing that happens where people resist if you're telling them what to do. However, you can still post the video and say, I was so moved by this. Let people draw their own conclusions. I can tell you that in the 14, no, 5, I mean, the years I've been doing this work, I mean, I have never said go vegan because I don't have to, because by the time I give the information and plant the seeds and just provide the information, I know people can draw the conclusions themselves. So I don't have to say, you need to watch this. I don't have to say, will you please watch this? All I have to do is say, this is an incredible video, or this was really moving for me. And so just mentally in your own mind, what I really encourage people to do is you get right in your mind saying, I'm not looking to educate anybody. I'm just looking to share the truth. And it sounds like a subtle, it sounds like it's the same thing, but it's not, because the difference is you're giving information and not having any attachment to what they do with it, or you saying, please watch this. And there's a difference just even in the tone and the way people respond. It's pretty remarkable. It's subtle, but it's really effective. Does mm-hmm. that make sense? Can you hear the difference in those two things? And I can tell you that, you know, again, all I can do is share my experience and say that's been the model for my work. And it does seem to work, because it just makes people more interested because they're doing it on their own accord. No one's telling them to do it. And that's kind of like basic human nature to kind of resist if you're telling us to do something. It's just kind of what happens.
Oh, yeah, and exactly. And I, you know, I'm just sensing this great silence out there. It's like I'm putting it all out there and there's just dead.
And the other part of this, absolutely. And the other part of this that has to be part of it is that it's not just in terms of what it does for the other person. So you planting seeds and letting go of how those seeds grow not only is more effective in terms of advocacy, but for your own mental health, you can only win and succeed if your intention is to plant seeds. you've won. You've done it. You've done exactly what you set out to do. If your intention is to change people, if your intention is to even educate people, because that's still an action that requires the other person to participate. Do you see what I mean? So if they're required to participate, you can't control that. You can't gauge it. You can't test it. You can't know if they are not answering you because they're just offline or because they're offended. All of that gets muckety muck in there if your intention is to educate. If your intention is just to be Bonnie and wonderful and plant seeds and let go of the rest, you've done it. You've done everything you've set out to do. So that would be my recommendation. Give it a try. Try it for, you know, for a couple of the posts. Do it for a week on Facebook, wherever you normally post. Just try it a little differently. Change the language. And again, in your own mind, change what your intention is. Be really clear about what that intention is. And see what happens. Just give it a test and see what happens. And let me know, because I want to hear what happens and want to see if it changes anything for you.
Great. I will.
Good.
I can
Good.
Feel the difference already.
Good. And you're going to feel it because you're just not going to be attached to them. Do they like me? Did I offend them? Mm-hmm. Did I upset them? You're just going to say, you know, that no one's going to feel offended because no one can argue mm-hmm. with, hi, I just wanted to share this on your own page. You know, it's very different. So give it a try. And I'm excited. Let me know. Let me know how it goes.
I will.
Good.
Thanks, Colleen.
Thanks, Bonnie. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Next, we have an email from Beth in Morristown, New Jersey, my old stomping grounds. Beth, I grew up in Summit in Livingston, and my husband's from Randolph, so I know Morristown well and love it. And Beth wrote, hi, Colleen, how do you feel about using a microwave? Do you have any facts about microwave use? I heard someone say that it depletes something like 70 or 80% of the nutrients. Is this true? Great question, Beth. This is a question a lot of people have, and of course, my answer is just based on sources that I look to and trust, but I guarantee you will find differing opinions all over the world, all over the interwebs, about microwaves. And in the end, all we can do is make our decision based on the information we have. So here is the information I have and the decision I have made based on that information. Here's what we know to be true. Microwaves are a form of electromagnetic energy that causes water molecules to vibrate and rapidly produce heat. That's what microwaves do, okay? They cook the outside first using the microwaves, and then heat is conducted to cook the interior of the food. So that's how it works, is the heat gets conducted into the center of the food. So microwaves have nothing to do with nuclear or radioactive energy, despite the fact that we call it nuking. To be honest with you, I am probably injuring myself in many ways, in how I sit, in how I overextend my arms, and how I overuse my eyes while I'm sitting at my computer than when I put a microwave oven on in the kitchen. To answer your question about microwaving destroying nutrients, the answer is no. I mean, all cooking changes the nutrients in foods in different ways, and microwaving is just one of those methods. So it's no different than when you're cooking using other methods. It's just another cooking method. So to answer your question, you know, there are people out there who are saying that, but from what I have read and from what I believe, from what I've read, you're not like losing all these nutrients in the food, but that's, you know, you're doing it when you cook in any way, you're changing the nutrients. When it comes to cook, I mean, your question obviously is about vegetables because obviously we're vegan, but the idea of cooking meat in a microwave really is really problematic for me because if you think about the way the heat's getting conducted to the center, you're going to have, and you often do, have a center that's not cooked. So eating raw animal flesh is just really, really disgusting. So I would not recommend cooking animal-based meat. I don't think you're going to get that cooked really well. But that's not your question because that's not an issue for us. So the point is I am less concerned about cooking in a microwave than I am about sitting in front of a computer all day. However, full disclosure, I don't have a microwave oven. Every apartment or house I've lived in has had one, and I only ever used it to heat up leftovers or to melt butter for popcorn. And when we started renovating the kitchen, as I said earlier, we had to decide, you know, which appliances we were getting for the kitchen. And I knew, and David knew, that we never use the microwave except to heat up, you know, my earth balance for popcorn. So we decided not to use precious space in our kitchen for an appliance we never use. I didn't not get it because it sucks nutrients from my food. It doesn't. Or because I think it's unsafe. I don't think it is. But I didn't get it because I wanted to use that space better for appliances that I do use. And now that I'm in the kitchen, the kitchen is not completely done, but I'm able to function in there. But prior to the kitchen being functioning, I was in my laundry room, and that's where I had all of my little appliances set up. And I had exactly what I needed. I had my blender, my hot water heater, I had my toaster oven, and my juicer, and that, and my air popper. Okay, so that was the other essential little appliance. But when I needed to heat up, I eat popcorn a lot. And when I would put butter on my popcorn, non-dairy butter, for those who think I'm talking about dairy butter, when I would put non-dairy butter on my popcorn, I would melt it in the toaster oven, and it was fine. And so now that we have this kitchen, I haven't melted butter since then in there, but I would do the same thing. So there's nothing I need the microwave for. And that renovation and living in the laundry room for 4 months and having that be my kitchen was my first test of living without a microwave. And I love it. I like it. And even in the toaster oven, I always do the survey when I'm teaching cooking classes, and I ask people who has a toaster oven and who doesn't. It's usually about 50-50. And I have to say, I love my toaster oven. And as I said, when I was down in that kitchen cooking, I made biscuits, I roasted Brussels sprouts, I baked sweet potatoes. I love a toaster oven. And so I think that serves us really well. And that's what I think. So if you have a microwave and you like it, it works for you, fantastic. Definitely get microwave safe dishes and plastic wraps for obvious reasons. But if it works for you, then that's my opinion. I don't really think, based on what I've read, that there's something to be concerned about. I would say step away from your computer, which I know I need to do more often, and take care of ourselves in that very practical way. So thanks, Beth. Thank you so much. Enjoy Morristown. I love that town. It's so pretty. And our final call today is from Carly.
Hi, Carly. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Thank you very much. Where are you?
I'm in Boise, Idaho.
Nice. What's it? This is so such a boring question, but what's the weather like there?
Freezing.
Is it?
Horribly cold. Yes.
Well, it's winter in Boise. Well, thank you for calling. Do you have a question?
I do. I'm such a big fan, so thank you so much for doing this. So my question is I've been a vegan for the last year and a half. Thank you very much. You have a big part in that. Mm-hmm. And recently I found out that I'm pregnant with twins. And the last year and a half, my husband and I have been really successful in being vegans with our families and our friends. And they've been pretty understanding. And I'm just a little bit nervous about going into the holidays with everybody knowing that I'm pregnant with twins. And I was just wondering if you have anything or any advice of what to say specifically now that I'm pregnant to people who have concerns about my diet.
So I'm going to guess they've had concerns about your diet before.
Right. Okay. Yep. And I was always able to kind of fend that off. And I guess it's just veganism is getting more and more known, at least I'm shoving it down their throat, right. I guess. And so now that I'm pregnant, I think that I'm just nervous about that part of it. And honestly, my doctor is okay with it. And there's all these sources that are okay with it. And you're just really good at summing up in really wonderfully kind, politically correct ways. do you have kind of something that I could say that would just maybe kind of fend off those concerns or put those to peace maybe?
Sure. So my feeling is that people, I'm going to guess because I have never been in that condition, but I am going to, I know that whenever someone's pregnant, everybody has an opinion about your pregnancy anyway. Everyone has something to say, right? I mean, you know, their own experiences, what worked for them, what didn't work for them, what you should eat, what you shouldn't eat, how much you should exercise,
right.
Whatever. Everybody has an opinion. So I would just suggest to you, the first thing I would suggest is that you not look at this as any different than what is already the case when you're pregnant. And it sounds like this is probably your first pregnancy, so you haven't had that experience before. But you know that too, right? I mean, everybody has an opinion about pregnant women. So if you go into this, just again, mentally, I think our own mental state and emotional state, I think, affects how others react to us and respond to us. And if we're kind of putting out vibes that we're a little nervous, that we're not sure, that we don't feel confident, or we don't feel confident answering even, then people are going to kind of feel like, okay, they might be able to get the upper hand and be able to, you know, say, no, this is really something to be concerned about. I mean, I know people who've had kind of that conflict for the entire 9 months or 6 months or whatever. And it's just, that's not fun, right? So you don't want that. So nipping it in the bud, I would say you go in mentally going, eh, everyone's going to have an opinion. Thank you for sharing. And I will, I appreciate your sharing that with me. But if you mentally are just thinking, no, this is their opinion, everyone's going to do it anyway, I don't, you know, I don't have to explain myself, defend myself, I don't have to become, you know, a registered nurse to explain that this is all fine.
I actually am.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So that's so funny. And I've never used
registered
nurse. But
somehow that makes
before.
People have more an opinion.
Like, sure. Right. That's so funny. I've never said registered nurse before. That's hilarious. So, so great. Well then good. That one you can just check off. So, you know, so I would say that, you know, don't make it a big deal. They already know you're vegan.
Okay.
They're going to know you're pregnant, you know, or you're going to tell them, what have you. And if they say, well, what about that? Say, yeah, it's great. My doctor feels, I'm so thrilled. My doctor, you know, it's wonderful. My doctor thinks it's wonderful too. And we're so happy. And you know what, if you keep getting pushback, you might have to say, you know, you're just going to have to wait like 6 months. Cause in 6 months you're going to see that everything's fine. I'm going to be fine throughout the pregnancy, and you'll see. And that always happens. I have found that once they have the baby or babies and they're healthy and they're pudgy and they're, you know, they're happy, then everybody relaxes. And then you can call back when you have to deal with the, oh my God, you're raising your child vegan. So that's going to be a different call that you can come back for.
Right.
But does that make sense? You know, if you just kind of play,
yeah,
just,
absolutely.
You know, it's all good. Let them, and you know, let them have their opinion. They're going to have it anyway, and thank them. And you know, you clearly sound like you have a great sense of humor. I think that's going to play a role in this. And I think everybody will feel a lot lighter if you're lighter about it when you go to them with that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I think I just needed your backup on it.
You sound like you know what you're doing. I'm so excited. Thanks, Carly. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Carly. And thank you, everyone. I am so impressed. I am so impressed by all of your thoughtful questions. And I look forward to hearing from you. So call, email, tweet, and I look forward to talking to you. And so we're going to close today's episode with The Compassionate Life, which I've mentioned is a new segment, and I'm going to be podcasting it separately, hence the short little introduction. And you can go to the website right now. I'm starting to podcast it, the audio files up there of the first one, and we're just going to keep doing this with the different segments. So stay tuned and enjoy, and please share it. The whole point of doing The Compassionate Life separately outside of the Food for Thought episode is so that you can have a succinct, perfect little essay that you can share with friends and family. Like Belen had said, it took her months before she listened to the full episode. Perhaps if she had just listened to maybe a shorter segment, she would have listened to the whole episode earlier. But nonetheless, that is what my intention is, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. And we'll enjoy listening, and we'll also be able to share it. So thank you for that. So we're going to close after The Compassionate Life. Welcome to The Compassionate Life. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. I'm an author and educator, empowering and encouraging people to live according to their own values of compassion and kindness. These are my own reflections and observations of what it means to live a compassionate life. Ethical vegetarianism outside of religious doctrine is not some newfangled novel idea. It harkens back thousands of years, and at its core is compassion, a universal principle grounded in religious and secular philosophies, resonating with men, women, and children all around the world, all across the ages. Many people think of veganism as a new reactionary trend against what we call factory farming. But for centuries, men and women have been thinking about, writing about, and expressing distress over the violence inherent in killing animals for human use and consumption. My personal veganism is part of a long continuum of men and women from ancient times until today who stopped eating animals and their eggs and milk, not because they witnessed a modern, mechanized, industrialized factory system, but because they didn't want to be part of the brutal and unnecessary process of turning sentient animals into butchered bodies. Sixth century philosopher Pythagoras abstained from the flesh of animals and advised his followers to do the same. Out of a sense of justice, not only for ourselves and our ancestors, he fervently believed in the transmigration of souls, but also for the animals themselves. Though we have no primary written texts of Pythagoras, the Pythagorean doctrine has been well pieced together from secondary sources, including Ovid's 9th century poem, Metamorphoses, in which he tells us that Pythagoras urged his acolytes to eat, quote, food that requires no bloodshed and no slaughter. Pythagoreanism was the word used to describe the abstention from animal-based meat right up until the 19th century. That's how influential Pythagoras was. Pythagoras was the first of many secular philosophers to contend that the killing of animals for consumption desensitizes us to the suffering of both human and non-human animals. Greek historian and essayist Plutarch, who lived from 46 to 120 AD, maintained this line of reasoning when he asked in his essay On the Eating of Flesh, who could wrong a human being when he found himself so gently and humanely disposed toward other non-human creatures? He saw no difference, Plutarch saw no difference between sadistic cruelty and customary butchery, declaring that the person who, quote, tortures a living creature is no worse than he who slaughters it outright, and that, quote, insensitivity and cruelty toward humankind follow savage exhibitions in the theater. For what sort of dinner is not costly for which a living creature loses its life, end quote. Similarly, it wasn't factory farms that 3rd century Greek philosopher Porphyry had on his mind when he wrote about the, quote, injustice of carnivorism in his essay on abstinence from animal food. Recognizing the fact that we have no physiological requirement for the flesh of animals, he lamented that we, quote, deliver animals to be slaughtered and cooked and thus be filled with murder, not for the sake of nutriment and satisfying the wants of nature, but making pleasure and gluttony the end of such conduct, end quote. Thus to do so, he wrote, is, quote, transcendentally iniquitous and dire. These anti-violence, pro-vegetarian sentiments did not occupy only our ancient predecessors. Modern Western figures, from artists and writers to scientists and politicians, were equally revolted by the slaughter and consumption of animals. Several prominent names stand out. In his 1516 novel called Utopia, about what an ideal society looks like, Thomas More wrote that the Utopians, quote, feel that slaughtering our fellow creatures gradually destroys the sense of compassion, which is the finest sentiment of which our human nature is capable. In 1736, French Enlightenment writer Voltaire attacked the, quote, barbarous custom of supporting ourselves upon the flesh and blood of beings like ourselves. Influential English philosopher David Hartley asserted, quote, taking away the lives of animals in order to convert them into food does great violence to the principles of benevolence and compassion. Percy Shelley, a vocal 19th century vegetarian, wrote passionately about many things, including the injustice of breeding animals only to kill them. He wrote, quote, if the use of animal food be, in consequence, subversive to the peace of human society, how unwarrantable is the injustice and the barbarity which is exercised toward these miserable victims. French poet Lamartine wrote movingly in the mid-1800s about growing up vegetarian, agreeing with his mother's conviction that, quote, to kill animals for the purpose of feeding on their flesh is one of the most deplorable and shameful infirmities of the human state. 19th century German composer Richard Wagner attributed his philosophy of fellow suffering not only to his vegetarianism, but also to the wellspring of his art, Celebrated Russian novelist and vegetarian advocate Leo Tolstoy wrote that his 1885 conversion to vegetarianism was based on the belief that eating animals is simply immoral for the sole reason that it involves the performance of an act which is contrary to moral feeling, killing. And the list goes on and continues into this, the 21st century. All that is to say, it is not how we breed, keep, and kill animals for human consumption that has been the impetus for vegetarianism for thousands of years. It is that we breed, keep, and kill animals for human consumption. Throughout the centuries, the common thread in the arguments against eating animals is the fact that since we have no nutritional requirement for the flesh or fluids of animals, killing them to simply satisfy our taste buds or habits or customs amounts to senseless slaughter. And senseless slaughter is no small thing. And so when I became vegan, I recognized, as so many others have before me, that the most rational, merciful, and obvious way to reflect my compassion for animals was to not eat them. The same compassion that penetrated Plutarch's heart penetrates mine. It is different neither in substance nor degree. The only difference between me and my compassionate forebears is the word we use to describe our desire to avoid causing someone else to suffer when we have the power to do so. From the time of Pythagoras in the 6th century all the way up to the 19th century, a Pythagorean diet signified one that was based on plants. That's what it was called. In the 18th and 19th centuries, proponents of the Pythagorean way often referred to it as a, quote, vegetable diet or vegetable regimen, although these are somewhat misleading phrases in that adherents did not subsist on vegetables alone, but also grains, fruits, nuts, seeds, legumes, and fungi. The word vegetarian first appeared in print in the Healthian magazine in 1842, though it is clear from its context that it would have been familiar to its audience by that time, leading etymologists to surmise that it was in use by at least the 1830s. And then, in the middle of the 20th century, in reaction to the word vegetarian, a young British animal activist named Donald Watson conceived a new word to better convey the ethics behind the diet. Watson was born in 1910 and died 95 years later in the northern region of England called Yorkshire. Intentional vegetarianism was not exactly widespread in the rural meat-eating community in which he grew up, but when asked about his journey to becoming vegan, Watson would speak of his childhood memories of seeing and hearing animals slaughtered or being dragged along alleyways to the butcher. He would speak about his visits to his Uncle George's farm, where various animals were kept and used. They all gave something, he recalled in an interview. The farm horse pulled the plow. The lighter horse pulled the trap. The cows gave milk. The hens gave eggs. The cockerel was a useful alarm clock. The sheep gave wool. I could never understand what the pigs gave, but they seemed such friendly creatures, always glad to see me. Then the day came when one of the pigs was killed. I still have vivid recollections of the whole process, including the screams, of course. One thing that shocked me was that my Uncle George, of whom I thought very highly, was part of the crew. I decided that farms and uncles had to be reassessed. The idyllic scene was nothing more than death row, where every creature's days were numbered by the point at which it was no longer of service to human beings. And so, repelled by violence and compelled by compassion, Watson became vegetarian and eventually vegan. A sensible response to the violence he witnessed on the small farms characteristic of his time and locale. That is to say, Watson did not stop eating animals because of industrialized slaughterhouses or the concentrated animal feeding operations that define today's meat, dairy, and egg industries. He saw even small-scale animal agriculture for what it is: exploitative, ugly, messy, unpredictable, difficult, cruel, and bloody. Not as the romanticized thing we've made it out to be when we talk about returning to small family farms. Watson went on to co-found the Vegan Society, the first vegan organization in the United Kingdom, which is still active today. A group called the Vegetarian Society was already in place by that time, having been founded in 1847, and was responsible for popularizing the word vegetarian, which originally referred to a plant-based diet that excluded all animal products, both flesh and secretions. Over time, however, diets called vegetarian began to include and embrace the consumption of eggs and animals' milk. Disheartened by this, Donald Watson set out to create a more concise word to describe ethical vegetarians who ate no animal products at all. And so in 1944, he, along with his wife Dorothy, decided on the word vegan by taking the first three and the last two letters of vegetarian, because as Watson explained, veganism starts with vegetarianism and carries it through to its logical conclusion. Watson emphasized its pronunciation as vegan, not vegan or vegan or vegan, and wrote its definition: a philosophy and way of living which seeks to exclude, as far as is possible and practical, all forms of exploitation of and cruelty to animals for food, clothing, or any other purpose. The word was accepted by the Oxford English Dictionary, and there it remains, alive and increasing in recognition. The word has gained traction in the public consciousness, especially in recent years, but misunderstandings still prevail about what it actually means, particularly the misconception that being vegan is about striving to be perfect, as if there is such a thing as a 100% pure certified vegan. Even Watson anticipated this when he clarified, as far as is possible and practical. I think one of the reasons people tend to equate veganism with perfection is that they're operating under the mistaken idea that being vegan is an end in itself. And so you find non-vegans trying to catch vegans in all the ways they're imperfect, stepping on insects while walking, driving a car whose tires contain animal products, wearing leather shoes left over from their pre-vegan days. And vegans, too, beating themselves up for accidentally eating something that contains eggs, or for not being able to afford to replace the leather couch they bought just before becoming vegan. But all of this entirely misses the point about what it means to be vegan. Being vegan is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end, and that end is compassion. Doing our best to not contribute to violence against animals when it is possible and practical. Being vegan is a powerful and effective means toward attaining that end, but it is not the end in itself. For The Animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.